First up, to developments in Syria, one of which this week was this. That's the new president of Syria, Ahmad al-Sharaa, buying a coffee at an old Damascus restaurant and paying by Visa card, a moment touted as a sign of Syria's effort to reconnect with global financial systems following years of sanctions. Earlier in the week, US Secretary of State Marco Rubio formally removed Syria's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism for the first time since 1979. And also this week, the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Force announced that it had dissolved, completing its integration with the Syrian military. Shortly afterwards, the leader of the SDF was appointed as an advisor to President al-Sharaa. So what do these developments tell us about the transition taking place in Syria after 14 years of civil war that killed at least 580,000 people and displaced many more? Joining us now from Damascus is the Syria correspondent for Al Jazeera English, Heidi Pett. Heidi, welcome back to Sunday Extra.
Great to be here.
Now, firstly, I wonder if you could give us some background on the Syrian Democratic Force and how significant its integration fully into the Syrian military this week is.
Yeah, so this is quite a big step. It's been one of the priorities for Ahmad al-Sharaa ever since he took power back in December of 2024 to reunify Syrian territory, because over the course of the war, there were lots of different armed groups of various size and various strength who had basically carved up Syrian territory. But one of the biggest and most powerful of them was the SDF. So it was formed more than 10 years ago. It was a sort of group of both Kurdish and Arab militias in the northeast of the country. And they then received a lot of American and international funding and backing for the fight against ISIS. You know, they were kind of pushed right up against the Turkish border. ISIS was taking over control of large swathes of both Syria and Iraq. And the fight back really began in this Kurdish town called Kobani. And the SDF then became incredibly powerful. They got a lot of funding, training, weaponry, intelligence sharing from the Americans, who also supported their campaign with airstrikes. And after that, they then expanded and took over. At one point, it was about a quarter of Syrian territory. And they held on to that. In fact, they even pushed out and expanded some of it in the madness of the collapse of the Assad regime. And since then, the new government here in Damascus has been in this ongoing process of negotiations with them about them coming and joining the rest of the Syrian state. And those negotiations, you know, sometimes they happened over a, you know, at a table at a meeting. But in January, those negotiations became a military confrontation, which the SDF lost. And so that's when they signed a formal agreement saying, okay, we will fold into and integrate into the Syrian state. And so in the last couple of days, we've had these big announcements saying that that process is complete. But the situation on the ground is actually a little bit more complex.
So it does look that the SDF has integrated from a much weaker position than perhaps it was early in the new government's rule. I wonder, Heidi, could you describe for us what the approach of President al-Sharaa's government to the Kurdish population as well as the SDF has been since taking power?
Yeah, so again, as part of these negotiations, this sort of wrangling that was sometimes a conversation, sometimes a military confrontation, what the SDF and the Kurdish population in Syria was hoping for was originally to maintain some degree of autonomy up in the northeast, because they weren't just a military force. They were basically running a semi-state up there. They had a whole administration. They had a justice system. They had an education system. And so they wanted to maintain some of that autonomy, but also specifically to maintain rights for Syria's Kurds, because back in the 1960s, loads of them were stripped of their citizenship. They wanted the right to be able to educate their children in Kurdish and Kurmanji. They wanted the right to interact with the state in their own language. They wanted citizenship and they wanted their cultural and citizenship rights to be respected. Now, a lot of promises have been made about that. Many Kurds have already been able to register as citizens. The details about the education and the language stuff is still being worked out. What we understand is that at least for the next year, there will be some compulsory classes in Kurdish in schools in those areas and things like that. But the approach from Ahmad al-Sharaa has been to apply pressure where he can to resolve this issue. And that's where we saw this military confrontation and now this agreement to integrate. Now, what's happening on the ground is a little bit different to the picture that's being presented here in Damascus, because actually, practically, It is still Kurdish-led forces who are manning checkpoints, who are conducting patrols. They're still wearing their old uniforms. A lot of the old command structures are still intact up there. So while about 4,000 of them have come to training facilities and been integrated into the Syrian army, and they're going to join these three brigades that have been agreed, the devil is going to be in the detail, and it's going to be in what happens on the ground over the next couple of weeks and months. And if there's any pushback as well from not just the SDF, which has announced that it's now dissolved, but what happens to all of those former fighters? They're armed, they're trained. Are the ones who haven't been offered jobs in the new Syrian army going to accept this?
Sounds like there's potentially a lot of devil in that detail. Heidi, Al Jazeera described the SDF as the largest force still outside the army. What other forces remain in Syria?
So the SDF was definitely the biggest and most powerful. There's a lot of other armed factions that have been imported or integrated into the army in varying degrees. So some of them have basically come in as whole units and, you know, their commander is still in control of his old men. Other ones, they've deliberately tried to split up to make sure that they don't have these individual units that aren't really under the command structure. But the other big unresolved question now is Sweida. So that's a Druze province in the south of Syria. The Druze are a sort of ethnic and religious minority here. And there was a lot of violence there in July of last year. There were clashes between Druze and Bedouins, and the Syrian government then sent its forces in. And the result is that Druze civilians were massacred by tribesmen aligned with the government, but also by government forces. And so as a result of that, the Druze community down there has become totally isolated. They don't trust the authorities in Damascus. It is basically sealed off. They've been receiving support from Israel. The main leader there, you know, he's talking about secession. He's talking about the creation of an independent state down there. So that is now the big unresolved question in terms of territorial integrity of Syria and in terms of armed groups that remain.
On Sunday Extra, we are speaking with Al Jazeera English correspondent for Syria, Heidi Pett. And Heidi, before President al-Sharaa and the head of the Reserve Bank could sit down for a coffee this week, Marco Rubio removed the designation of Syria as a state sponsor of terror, describing it as eliminating the final major barriers to private sector investment in Syria and promoting its economic recovery. How has that news been received in Syria, and how significant do you see it being?
People are really, really happy to see this, because Syria was under such a layered sanctions regime. It wasn't just this state sponsorship of terrorism listing. There were sanctions on individuals, there were sanctions on the state from America, from the EU, from Australia. And what that does practically on the ground is it meant that Syria has been isolated from the rest of the world for years. The state sponsor of terrorism listing went back to 1979, but most of the sanctions were more recent, related to, you know, the repression of the revolution and then the war that followed. And it means that it's very hard to import anything into Syria. So even hospitals were not able to import like radiology equipment that they needed to diagnose cancer patients. It's difficult to get medicine. It's difficult to import agricultural equipment and things like that that are needed to feed the population. But it also means that Syria has been totally cut off from the international banking system. So you haven't been able to use a bank card in Syria. Everything runs on cash. And so the hope is that it makes it easier for Syrians in their day-to-day lives. But also the key part of this is about investment, because Syria desperately needs money to rebuild. The cities are devastated. There is rubble everywhere. And the strategy from the Syrian state is to acknowledge that they don't have the capacity to do all of that rebuilding themselves. They are hoping specifically for foreign investment. They're not really interested in, you know, big loans and programs from like the World Bank and the IMF, although that has been welcomed. What they really want is businessmen, whether it's Syrians who've gone abroad, people from the Gulf or elsewhere, to come in and rebuild these suburbs and these towns and cities. But these sanctions have been part of the roadblock to that. Now, it doesn't mean that everything is going to change. There will be delays, and there's also still questions about the financial and investment environment in Syria, about transparency. You know, there's this big sovereign wealth fund. Nobody really knows how much money is in it or how it's being spent. And so, yes, it's good that the sanctions have been lifted, but international businessmen and international companies are still going to have some questions that they want answered about what's actually happening here.
BBC reporting put this move down to America wanting to bring Syria more into its orbit than that of Russia or China. Is that your sense of what the new government actually wants to do? And what is the state of the previously close relationship between Russia and Syria?
So Ahmed Ashraa is a deeply pragmatic man, and he has been leading a deeply pragmatic campaign over the last 18 months or so since he took power. And so he has been willing to have conversations with just about anyone. You know, there are very few countries that he has really cut off, with the exception of Iran, actually. And so, yes, he has a good relationship with America. Specifically, he has a good relationship with Donald Trump. You know, he's been invited to the White House, he's had meetings there, and that was part of the clearing the path to lifting the first round of American sanctions.
Well, Donald Trump certainly likes a tough guy, and President al-Sharaa seems to be one of those.
I mean, that's exactly what he said, right? He said he was a handsome man with a strong past, and basically, you know, it's like he loves a strong man. But that doesn't mean that Sharaa has cut off countries that were previously allied with the Assad regime, and the biggest one was Russia, right? And that is a little bit complicated domestically, because people here in Syria, they remember the Russian warplanes bombing their towns and cities. They understand what Russia's support of the Assad regime meant for them and their families. There were significant Russian military bases in Syria, in the northeast, but also on the coast. There's two big naval bases. And so Sharaa has been negotiating with the Russians about those. And in the last couple of weeks, actually, they reached an agreement that part of that is going to be handed back to the Syrian state. So some of those naval bases will be turned into civilian facilities for import and things like that, but that the Russians are still maintaining some kind of presence and partnership here in Syria. They will still be there. It's being described as basically a training partnership.
The US also this week mediated talks between Israel and Syria in Jordan, after Israel, of course, attacked a Syrian airbase near the border with Turkey. Did those talks produce much progress?
These talks have been part of an ongoing attempt, more on the Syrian side than the Israeli side, I would say, to reach some kind of agreement or understanding, which would mean that Israel stops bombing Syria and stops the incursions and the expansions in southern Syria in the occupied Golan Heights. Because ever since the regime fell, Israel has been trying to control what's happening here in Syria. You know, they say that they're worried about security threats on their northern border. They're worried about armed groups who may attempt to make cross-border attacks into Israel, much as we saw with Hezbollah from Lebanon as well. And so what that has meant on the ground is that in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the regime, they bombed hundreds of targets in Syria in that first couple of days. And they basically destroyed the Syrian Air Force. And they also destroyed Syrian air defenses. And then since then, they've also been conducting raids and patrols, and they've been arresting civilians as well in the towns and cities that are along that border area where they've expanded their zone of occupation. And the Syrian government has basically at every turn sought to de-escalate. And so they've said that they are open to a security agreement with Israel, but they also understand that that's tricky domestically for them. There is a great antipathy among many Syrians towards the state of Israel because of the occupation of Syrian territory and bombing. And so they're really treading this tightrope between making sure that the attacks which threaten to destabilize Syria, which is not exactly what they're after right now, making sure that that stops, while also not being seen to have capitulated to Israel or to have accepted this status quo where Israel is occupying quite a lot of Syrian territory.
And finally, Heidi, what's the reaction been in Damascus and more broadly to the series of criminal convictions for senior Assad-era figures and, of course, the in absentia death sentence on former President Assad himself?
Most people here are very happy to see that what feels like some kind of justice is being done. You know, these were very high-profile trials here in Syria. The problem, of course, is that Bashar al-Assad, the former president, and a number of the senior members of his regime fled the country. They went to Russia. It's very, very unlikely that they will be extradited from Russia. It is now even less likely because they have been handed down a death sentence. And that is one of the complications that many people here are aware of. While, yes, they're happy to see the wheels of justice turning, the fact that these death sentences have been handed down, and particularly in absentia, does mean that it's less likely that any other fugitives from the former regime will be extradited from other countries where they might be currently hiding, because states that don't have the death penalty often have rules that they can't hand somebody over to a country that does. And so there are some Syrians who are, you know, worried about what this means for future chances for justice for other figures from the former Assad regime. There's people who feel that this process has been a bit rushed, you know, that it's maybe even a missed opportunity, because the sentences for Bashar al-Assad and other senior members, they were kind of wrapped in as almost a side project for the trial of this man called Atef Najib. He's a cousin of Assad. He was the former head of political security in the city of Daraa, where the repression that he meted out to protesters is widely credited as basically lighting the spark of the Syrian revolution. So it was very symbolic. He was tried. There were witnesses and evidence and everything like that. And then the cases against Bashar and others were kind of wrapped into that. And so there are some people who feel that we could have had a trial for the former president where, even if he wasn't physically in the dock, there was a sort of moment of national truth-telling and reconciliation that could have happened if people came and gave evidence. That's not what happened. But in general, I would say the majority opinion is that people are happy to see this. Atef Najib in particular, they don't just want to see him executed. They want to see him hanged out the front of the Al-Amari Mosque, where the forces under his control massacred protesters.
Well, there is certainly never a dull moment on your current beat, Heidi Pett. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thanks for having me.
That's the Syria correspondent for Al Jazeera English, Heidi Pett.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.